Welcome to Adventures of a Blonde Geisha.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Adventures of a Blonde Geisha. My name is Lisa Wilkerson, and I am the host of this fabulous podcast. Thank you so much for always joining me for all my eventful episodes. Today, I have a very special fabulosity guest who I know from my crazy cray cray days back in Tokyo, which is where we met, Linda Kovalik-san! Linda-san! Hello, hello! How are you?
So good, so good. So happy to be on this fabulous podcast. Love it!
I love you, and you were such a big part of my life in Japan. But before we get into the Tokyo days and all the cray cray that happened in our days in Tokyo, I want to get a little bit about your backstory because it's really, I think it's really interesting and I think people really resonate with it. You grew up in South Dakota.
Yeah, but here's the funny part, Lisa. No one's going to resonate with this part. Yes, I grew up. No one will resonate. I grew up in Brum, South Dakota. And most recently, I found out there are things on the planet called points of inaccessibility. And yeah. I think poles of inaccessibility. And there's one like in, you know, between Xinjiang province and Kazakhstan in, you know, in Asia. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder where the pole of inaccessibility is in America or North America for that matter. Bum, bum, bum. About an hour from my house. An hour from my house. That's and that fabulous. Literally means, you know, one of the spots that's just the furthest from the ocean. And you know, the kind of place you'll probably live through, in a nuclear winter or something, just because nothing's there, nothing hits it, bombs can't touch it, that kind of place. But beautiful, but so lovely.
I love it. So you lived in South Dakota, right?
Rapid City. Grew up in Rapid City, South Dakota, which is the southwest corner of South Dakota. And the lucky thing here is half of my state has much in common with the half of North Dakota. Half of it is plain. So if you're talking East Dakotas, it's very much of a plain and flat boom. But my little corner of the world is where, you know, the Black Hills meet the dinosaurs. You know, there's these lovely little hills that kind of gradually get bigger and bigger as you creep towards Colorado to the Rockies. So beautiful mountains, place called the Badlands where dinosaurs are found. Utterly fascinating. Native American, Sioux Indian, fantastic culture, really an exciting place to be. But at the same time, you know, the sky just never ends. And I remember being a kid looking at, you know, planes high up in the sky, leaving, you know, their trails. And I would always think, where are these people flying to? And, you know, flash forward, you know, numerous decades later, I remember when I would be flying from, say, from Asia to, you know, it was to like Chicago, and I would be flying over South Dakota high above, you know.
So how did you, because I know that you left South Dakota when, how old were you? You were in you're still in your teens, no?
Yeah. Because I went away to university. So I was still in my teens. I was kind of a young university starter. I think I was 17 and went to university in Wisconsin, a school called Marquette University. Uh-huh. And then shortly after that, when I graduated, the summer I graduated, I headed to China. But I was thinking to myself very recently about like, why I think it's not just me, but that generation was very open to kind of just getting out and experiencing the world. I think now in that case, especially me, because when you come from a pole of inaccessibility, you want to kind of look at what's more accessible. And so I was really excited to go out and to see the rest of the world. But in retrospect, when I look at, I had a lot of influences, certainly. My mother had spent some time in Japan. She went to high school in Japan in Sendai, and you know that. Mm-hmm. And my mother and dad both also were in Korea together when my dad did his military service at a hospital in South Korea. He and mother went, and they loved it. So I grew up up on kimchi and sushi and, you know, Asian art in our house. So there, I always was predisposed certainly to Asia. But when I look back to at just, you know, the 80s music, because music does influence a generation without doubt.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, which freaks me out for my daughter's generation. Like, what kind of influence is she getting? But
yeah.
Because, you know, nothing beats the 80s, really.
I agree.
You're going to love this, Lise. I was thinking about the music that influenced me.
Yeah.
And okay. Africa. Remember the song?
Yes,
Toto. You remember how?
Yes, I love that song.
So evocative, so exciting, so exotic. And, you know, you're thinking of other foreign lands to visit. And then another song, I Come From the Land Down Under. Remember, Lise?
Men at Work. I remember.
The land of Vegemite sandwiches. What is this? Have to go. Where the men chunder. What is chunder?
Yes.
Gotta learn about it.
Yeah.
Or remember Bangkok, Oriental City.
Yes.
One night in Bangkok and the world is what is this Exactly. So subtly, you've got these influences too, just in music, of these exotic, fabulous places where adventure is to be found. And so that's kind of just like rippling through my veins. And interestingly, at the same time, one night, my dad brought home this most amazing woman. She was my dad was happily married.
Yeah. For dinner or whatever, right? Yeah.
Brought home, no. It was his med student. So he had a med student working under him. Rare that he had would have a student. But she was the most amazing woman. She was not Amish, but it'll come to me. It's something like
this.
No. It's like Amish, not Hutterite, Amish. Mennonite. She was Mennonite.
Oh, yes, yes. She was Mennonite.
So fascinating. And so I'm saying, tell me about your life. And she said, well, I spent a lot of time in Nepal. And I'm like, Nepal, because I just had watched Raiders of the Lost Ark. And quite frankly, I wanted to get a job at that bar that the whole movie opened up in. I'm like, I want to go to Nepal. Tell me about Nepal. And she
and hang out with Harrison Ford. Yes.
Well, that's what I thought life was like. And yeah, and, you know, eat some Vegemite and chunder with the Aussies.
Exactly.
So she was telling me, I'm like, how do you even get there? So she was talking about flying into it was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Fly into Kathmandu, catch a bus to the next port of call, get on a bicycle to the next port of call, and then walk the rest of the way to where her family was doing like volunteer work with the local people. And it was just so exotic and so fabulous. So in my world then, it was all kind of making sense. I grew up with Asian influences. The music of the world and the movies of the world were saying, go out and find your adventure. And then she really clinched it for me. And she told me, you know, how you do it. And that it's not always easy. And that, you know, sometimes you do have to walk and take a bike and take a bus and da-da-da-da. So I was really prepared for it. So when I graduated from university, there was, interestingly, a job in northern China, in Manchuria.
Mm-hmm.
And Liesl, my geography was so crappy that I thought Manchuria was kind of part of the Himalayas and just right around the corner from Nepal.
Makes sense to me.
So I'm like, okay, cool. I'll take the job in Manchuria and I will get easily, I'll just pop into Nepal. I'll finish the job and I'll go to Nepal.
Go to the bar, say, hey guys, I'm here for happy hour. Oh, but I'm leaving to go back to Manchuria after happy hour.
Exactly. All of these things just added to the exoticness of life. Manchuria, of course.
Yes.
And then I didn't even watch Manchurian Candidate till later and realizing how bizarre. But it was crazy because, you know, Manchuria, as you know, ended up in a province called Changchun, which means eternal spring, which the joke was on everybody else who thinks it means eternal spring. It actually is more like eternal winter because it was very close to Harbin and Siberia and literally a hop, skip, and a jump from North Korea as well.
Wow. So
I think I've told you about it. I mean, it was just nutball because even in those days, some people were still wearing Mao outfits, you know, that olive green outfit with the hat.
Wow. And yeah.
Any foreigner they thought was a spy. And in those days, China was just starting its development. And it was amazing. Beautiful buildings were cropping up and all that kind of thing, but not in Changchun. And I just remember one wintry day, I was riding my bike, hoping to find warmth because my building didn't have electricity that day. So I was on my way to what's called the Friendship Store because I figured they'll have electricity. I need to warm up.
What was the Friendship Store? What was the
Okay. Friendship Store is fascinating. A Friendship Store, this is great. Okay, so I lived in China during the days of dual currency, two different currencies. This is why black markets exist, because one of the currencies was called FEC, foreign exchange currency. It was literally regarded as, in English as FEC or Weihui. The other one was renminbi, the people's, literally meaning the people's money. And so two different currencies. If you wanted to buy anything at the Friendship Store, it was mostly imported goods. Things you couldn't find in the markets. And so you'd have to pay with foreign exchange currency. Okay. But once I learned about the black market, oh my gosh, you could change either US dollars or foreign exchange currency for renminbi and get like five times more. And actually, I'm going to quickly jump because that's a really funny story. One day I changed money. I was on my way to the bank and somebody popped out of nowhere and just said, change money. And I'm like, these Chinese are so efficient. They even have like people outside the bank to, you know, I thought this is major efficiency. So I'm like, whoa, and your deal is fabulous. I got this amazing deal on this money change. Anyway, a few hours later, I went back to my building and there were police everywhere. And I'm like, hi guys. And they're like, are you Linda? Did you change money in front of the Bank of China? And I said, yes, I did. And it was fantastic. I love it. It was great. It was wonderful. And then they said, but did you change money on the black market? I said, I did not change money on the black market. No, I didn't. But they said, you changed money in front of Bank of China. I said, yes, in front of Bank of China. And they said, in the black market? Not the black market.
Different.
I thought black market, you know, people wore like black turtlenecks and berets. I thought it was literally physically underground. I was that clueless because I had this fantasy version of the black market and I didn't think it was some dude popping out of a bush in front of a bank. And so,
which does sound a bit suspect to me.
No, I know, but Lise, you cannot imagine how unworldly I was and how kind of gullible. This is the beauty of us Dakotans. We're trusting.
Yeah.
And so it was a back and forth of, did you change money? Yes, I changed money. With the black market? Not in the black market. And so pretty soon they just thought I was an idiot. And they said, this was great. I had to do what's called a criticism session. I had to write a self criticism. So they said, you just have to, on this piece of paper, please write that you changed money and sign your name and that say you'll never do it again. I'm like, well, I still don't understand, but okay. They gave me this page and I wrote, to this day, I'll never forget. I was at the Bank of China and I did change money, but not in the black market with a guy outside of the Bank of China. But I stress again, not on the black market. It was a
one came out of the bushes, but not in the black market.
Not in the black market. And I just want to say that I thought it was very efficient and I just love, I love it. And I think that China has a lot to teach America. Thank you very much, Linda Kavorek. And it was all in English. They couldn't speak English. I submitted it and they were happy and they let me go. So that was a classic story. And that wasn't my last self-criticism. I had to do a few while living in China. But, you know, wonderful, wonderful. But just to quickly finish my Changchun story, that morning, the day I was looking for electricity, on my bike, you know, swerving in the snow, trying to get to this Friendship Store. And in front of me was in those days, they still had like buggies with horse-drawn kind of. And this particular buggy would go and clean out public lavatories. And I was told the word for what it's called night soil. When they take the stuff out of the lavatories and put it on, you know, what we would know as number two. They know as night soil. And anyway, this whole wagon, this massive wagon was full of night soil. And, you know, and this horse, this little donkey horse was kind of running it and I'm behind it. So I can smell it. And I thought to myself, well, at least it's emanating heat. There's some warmth coming from this. Number one, the smell, whatever. But I just thought if I slide into this, I'm just going home. I'm just going to, the adventure's done and I'm going home. But anyway, I didn't slide into it. I make my way to the Friendship Store. I was super happy. I ran in and wah, wah. no electricity. And that day I did think I was going to die.
So did that happen a lot though, when you were living there? Like there would be all of a sudden just randomly like no electricity or.
Hell yes. Yeah. So three times a week. And we knew the times because it would be like electricity sharing through the city. I more or less knew the times that there would be no electricity. And so it was cool. And I mean, within a month, I'd already met so many students from other universities. And Lise, you're going to love this. An engineering university really close to mine was full of the most fun, intelligent, wonderful Africans on the planet. They were all there. They were studying like electrical engineering in Mandarin. Just brilliant people.
Wow.
They loved to party. So every weekend we had dance parties at the university. Those guys were hilarious and fun and wonderful. And we'd be hanging with North Koreans, Russians,
these Africans
from countries I'd never heard of. I literally didn't know where Gabon was, but I quickly tooled up. That was my incentive. I'm like, Linda, you got to memorize this. You got to like learn your geography. First of all, you screwed up in Manchuria. And second of all, you don't know. I'm meeting people from Seychelles, Gabon, Zambia, Burundi. And so I'm like, Linda, you got to learn this stuff. So I said, and that was really the beginning of my education.
So how long were you living there for?
I was only in Changchun, I think, for a year. And then I made my way down to Beijing. And I was in Beijing for like, I think 4 years. And I was working with, I ended up getting a job with UNESCO, United Nations Education Scientific Organization, doing some speech writing and, project proposal work and assisting my direct boss, who was the most charming, charismatic, amazing North Korean. So, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on that separately too, of just on UNESCO and the crazy, crazy times there. Because I'll throw in a little nugget here. But again, this is a whole nother podcast. We had a person, one old man who said he had two brains and that he had a lot to share with the world. And because we were, he was either connected to education, science, or culture. So he felt it was relevant that his message got out. We also, people would come into our office who said they were extraterrestrial. Again, they felt like, they fell under a pillar of science, education, or culture. And so we had a lot of wacky whackness. And some guy who invented he gave me like a 2-inch thick document handwritten in Chinese about like some kind of mathematical equation that would transform the planet. So a lot of fun. UNESCO was wonderful. Not only did we do meaningful work, but there were some crazy, kooky, fabulous stories there at the same time. And that's really my love affair of adventure just got, really solidified with the people I was meeting and the crazy things that were happening. Crazy, wonderful. I mean, very similar to your experience, I think, in Japan. There's always like a hard side to becoming part of a new culture. But in my case, the adventure took, really kind of
took precedent.
Took precedent. And that's what kept me just addicted to it.
Wow. So when did you move to Hong Kong? Because I know you've been here in Hong Kong for quite a while now.
Yeah, quite a while. So after China, I met my husband, Charles. I met Charles in Beijing and we got engaged and we lived in Australia for 2-3 years in between. And I really, the calling of Asia just was calling me back. We were in Australia for a few years. And the funny thing that I learned was when you think a culture is close to your own, that's when you have the largest cultural shocks. When you're not expecting, and it was more than Vegemite and men chundering,
Men at work did not give us all the 411 for sure.
No, exactly. And it's those subtleties, I think probably similar to when you moved to America.
Correct.
It's meant to be your culture, but there was so much that was different to you.
Disconnect, total disconnect. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? But we kind of come from the same place, but no. Yeah, totally.
Exactly. And so that was the weirdest part of all. It's just it's a little things that were just bizarre. So where I come from, when people talk on the phone and when they say goodbye, like, okay, all righty then. Oh, sure. Okay, bye-bye. That's how we do it. That's how we used to do it in South Dakota.
Yeah.
And in Australia, it was like, okay, bye. And I just remember, and Aussies, if there are any Aussies listening to this, like, we don't do that. Well, for some reason, at that point in time, I just, for me, the speed at which an Australian used to hang up the phone was a lot different from the slow-moving Dakota phone hang up. And so it was just little tiny things that were just throwing me off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I was more equipped to handle it in China and even Japan than I was to handle the differences in Australia. Yeah.
Yeah, because you know that there's going to be so many differences. So you kind of prepare yourself for that. So I have like a phone story too, where when I first came back here and I was on the phone, I was bowing, of course, right? Because I'm like talking to someone, even if it's in English, I'm like bowing on the phone. And these people are looking at me like, why are you bowing? Like, what are you doing? Why are you so weird? Why are you bowing? I'm like, oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. So yeah, I totally get it. It's the really small things that kind of just really throw you off completely, you know? Yeah.
It's like a shade of nuance. It's different from being slapped in the face with like, oh my gosh, you know, with the oh my goshes, which there were a ton in China, but it was more of like shaded nuance in Australia that I just found more like, really? You expect it to be the same way you're used to, and it's just not.
Yeah.
And so that was fascinating to experience, and it was just fascinating to experience.
Yeah.
But I loved it nevertheless. So,
yeah.
But anyway, we were, Charles and I both were headhunted for a job in Shanghai then. So when that came up, I was like, Charles, I can't, you know, I'm really missing the excitement of Asia and specifically China. So we went back to Shanghai in 97, did a few years there, and then ended up in Hong Kong with the ad agency Leo Burnett in 99.
Mm.
Yeah. And I mean, you've been to Hong Kong. It is
amazing.
It's amazing.
Yes. I love it. I do love it. Yeah. It is one of my favorite cities in the world, I think. I love Hong Kong. But then, of course, I am very lucky because when I go, I stay with you and I go to all your favorite restaurants and everything, you know, so I get like a real good look into the city that I think a lot of times, you know, people who are there as tourists don't really get, right? But
yeah. There's a lot of different levels of Hong Kong. There's what you can learn from, you know, through the internet and all the tours you can take. And even if you do some good, great research, you know, there's a lot that you can learn and see.
Yeah.
But with that local knowledge, you know, I can take you to, you know, the holes in the walls that I love. You know, there was this, this restaurant I used to go to. I don't think I took you to it because it may have closed down by then. For years and years and years, there was this place that existed under a bridge. I didn't even realize I shouldn't say bridge. It was a flyover and it was tented. And anyway, it was just a lot of older, you know, people, older chefs cooking like different soups. And it was fascinating. I felt it was very Blade Runner, and I had Blade Runner moments in Japan as well, but this was very Hong Kong Blade Runner. And it was just that's when you could learn some really wacky local customs, like not customs, but behaviors. There was this big, plastic bag full of water. So imagine like a Ziploc bag full of water hanging like on the wall or in where I used to have my soup on this kind of fence. And I was like, what is that for? And apparently putting those up kept flies away.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I tell you what, when you come to Hong Kong, you just, it may be the buzz of the city too, that kind of stops flies. But one thing we don't really, it's very rare to see is flies. Very rare. So little things like that, you'll notice and go, what? And, you know, just it. Yeah. And it, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. Do you think, cause you know, I mean, really like I talk a lot in my podcast about being a third culture kid or a TCK, and you didn't grow up in a, you know, in a different culture, but you basically are a TCK. Like you really are, because you've spent so much more time in other cultures and other countries than you have in America, right?
You are right. Now I've been 30. So I'm at 30 plus years, 31 years, I think now in Asia.
Yeah.
And I left America when I was 21. So I've been more kind of influenced, I guess, by Asia Pacific and the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
Than my own culture. Yeah. Now, admittedly, American culture pervades, you know, it seeps out. Seeps out through the movies. Yeah. It seeps out through the movies and music. And so much of the American culture now is weaving in the tapestry of many other local cultures. And I've witnessed it. I've witnessed that with China, where it was a very specific Chinese traditional way. And I'm seeing more of an international flavor weave in. It's not just America, but many.
Yeah.
And so for me in marketing, it makes my job a bit easier because I can understand this younger generation a lot more because they're influenced by the same things I've been influenced by, you know, but just different. So even though they grew up in a Chinese world but have been influenced by international, you know, by global influences, I've grown up in a Western world, but very much influenced by Asian influences. So it's a different way of looking at it. And it's very powerful. One thing, I mean, my avenue in third culture, I think has led me to feeling extremely, I'm not going to use the word global, and I'm not going to use the word international, but I really think, I hope that the world will end up, we'll all start feeling really like, this is going to sound really cheesy.
Totally, totally. Okay. We love cheese on my podcast.
A little bit of fromage right now.
Fromage.
I'm really feeling like an earthling in a way, because I think eventually we'll all keep our cultures. And that's something I really learned through UNESCO, that preserving local cultures is so important to who, you know, to earth, you know, to who we are as this larger extended cultural family. So that's critical.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
and yet this, we're understanding each other better again through our music, through our movies. You know, nowadays we watch Indian, subcontinent Indian movies.
Yeah. And Indian music. Like on Netflix and all the, you know, streaming channels. Yeah.
Exactly. So we're really, there's this global flavor now that's happening. And I think it's super important. And you and I have spoken a lot about, you know, what people call cultural appropriation. I find that a very dangerous concept to look at it as appropriation. Because, you know, for example, if you look at the English language, it's grown because of borrowing of language. You know, think of all the French we use in our language, and, you know, and other words we use in our language, and how it's influenced by pop culture. And I don't believe in appropriation. I think that this culture should be shared. It should be shared. It should be celebrated. And we should all through culture, we grow and we get closer. It's kind of like through food as well. Like I can get to know a culture through its food. Japan, and it's, you know, those just power-packed subtleties in its scene. Gosh.
Yeah. And I do think in some way, I think that Anthony Bourdain, I think that was one of the things that I loved about his show that he did, you know, where it was like appreciating different cultures and sharing of cultures. I mean, he never really knew the language, right? Everywhere he went. But I used to love watching the show that he did where he would travel all over, you know, and just be so open to a lot of the cultural differences, the food differences, just everything. Like, I love that. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because we've got five senses. We don't just, you know, it's not monosense. You know, we've got five senses.
Yeah.
And so there's maybe more actually. And there are many, many ways to experience a culture. And we should, because it really does help you understand. I mean, when I, you know, the tastes of lemongrass and fish sauce in Southeast Asian cultures.
Love.
It complements the conversation you're having with a local, or, you know, or the Vietnamese coffee at that moment. And when they tell you stories of, you know, drop another fromage word of yesteryear, dropping stories of yesteryear. It's like surround sound. You just get it better. And this is something that more people in the world need to experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that that comes one from traveling, but then also because I have tons and tons and tons of favorite parts to you, my darling. But one of my favorite things about you is how you love hearing stories. Like you love getting people's journeys. And I think in that way, like we kind of connect, like I love that too. And I love that you are curious about those kind of things, you know? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Storytelling. Well, because what I do in advertising, I'm a strategist.
Yes.
We need to understand, like, what is the story behind the product? What's the story behind the target audience? What are the stories? And my father always said that, you know, every single human being has a story to tell and you need to pick their brains. Dad taught me that. And, And so he said, you know, there might be a quiet person sitting next to you. They have a story. Yeah. You can pull it out.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm quite practiced at that. And yeah. I remember too, at my university, we had to take like a 1-credit, 10-week colloquium, which is, and it was, you know, easy A, and that's my kind of class. And it's when the Jesuits were telling him, it really was. And the Jesuit said, if you remember one thing in these 4 years, and I'm like, yes, I'm into one thing.
Okay, what is it?
Yes, what is it? And you know what he said? It was great. The professor was fantastic. He said, we're setting you up with this liberal arts education to impassion you, to encourage you to learn how to learn and to never stop learning.
Hmm.
And people's stories, I worked with some amazing people at Beacon in Tokyo, and one of we had this lovely, lovely man who he was from Dentsu, but he was working at Beacon, and his I think I told you some. Which one was Pico-chan and Peko-chan? One was the
candy is Peko-chan.
Yeah, Fuji. Well, it was Mr. Fuji, and he lives. Peko-chan. Peko-chan's the boy.
Yes.
Mr. Fuji is Peko-chan. So his grandfather and father, his grandfather established the Fujiya chocolate company, right?
Yes. Which is super famous. So actually, no, Peko-chan is the girl.
Oh, okay. Then he's Peko-chan.
Yeah. Peko-chan is the guy. But I ate Peko-chan candy all the time. The milk candy. It was so fabulous. I love Peko-chan candy. Yes.
And I know. And so people would say, oh, you know, Mr. Fuji, that's him. And da, da, da. I got to know Mr. Fuji because he's the nicest man in the whole wide world. And he and I, we'd sit down and talk about a lot of things. I'm like, tell me about your life.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we've got, because they have a chocolate company, they had a dairy farm, lots and lots of cows up in Hokkaido. And I said, oh my gosh, tell me about that. What happened? He said, well, my parents were strict and they would send me up to Hokkaido to work on the farm in the summers. And I said, oh, your family must be amazing. So he talked about working on the farms in the summers. And then I would ask about his father and his grandfather. And, you know, you'd be so surprised how people open up. They really open up. And he told me some really intimate, personal, emotional stories about his grandfather having to do military service in the old days and spending some time in China and really being terribly moved by what happened in China.
Yeah.
And there's some really gruesome stuff that happened.
Yep.
I learned more from him than the history books. And just knowing that his grandfather, you know, lived through that and came back and imparted these stories to his kids. Mm-hmm. It's very, 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 very powerful. And So I learned more actually from people who I met and the stories that they told.
Mm-hmm.
And it was super powerful. Like your story, Liesl. I mean, I always tell people your story too, growing up in Japan, like you did. The funniest bits are though when you end up back in America and people think you're American and you're just not.
Not. And I totally have no idea. Like all these zone moments, as I call them, you know, like with the telephone where I'm like nodding while I'm on the phone. And then, and I will say, I still do this to this day. Like I still nod when I'm on the phone. And I also will kind of do this whole, right? And in Japanese, you do that, right? Like,
yes.
You know? But when you do it in English, people think you're weird. And they're like, what is she doing? Like, what?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy.
You can pick up little things that you love from the culture. So in Hong Kong, when they register what you said and they're doing it, because Chinese are fast. And this is what I love about mainland Chinese and Hong Kong people. We just are fast. And I love it about
them.
And they just say, hi, hi, hi. So the minute you registered something, just go, hi. And that's what I say. I love it. I've adopted that into how I roll. I've also adopted pronouncing the letter H in the word herb. I like it. I learned it in Australia. I say herb. I'm putting it out there.
For the longest time, I didn't know that it was herb. I thought it was herb because in Japanese, it's herb. So
everywhere else in the world.
Yeah. And aloe, I thought was aloe.
So oh my gosh, I love it. Aloe.
When I first came to the States, you know, I mean, like what? I was like 38, 39. And I was like, oh, I would like some aloe vera. And they're like, aloe vera? Like what? What's wrong with you? Oh my gosh, I had no idea.
Oh my gosh, that is fantastic. I remember when I was in Japan for the first time and I'm with my daughter, Alexandra, you know, Allie. She was little and I just wanted to get to a McDonald's to get some ice cream.
Oh boy.
And so I'm asking people, you know, like, here's me, McDonald's Doko Deska. And people are like, okay, I got the Doko Deska part, but they're like, McDonald's? McDonald's?
Yeah.
I'm like, how can they not know McDonald's? And then finally someone is like, oh,
McDonald's.
And I'm like, what? And so I was so excited then to always pronounce Macudonaldo. We still do it. So that's another one I've kept. Macudonaldo.
Macudonaldo. Now they just, because they abbreviate everything, right? So now they say, Macu.
To the Macu.
Macu. And then Starbucks, I only learned about this like 7 or 8 years ago, but a girlfriend of mine, Miyuki, who I think you met at some point, but she was like, Lisa, let's meet at Stubba. I'm like, what's Stubba? And she's like, gomen, Starbucks. I'm like, what? You guys call it Stubba? Like, what are you doing? Why are you butchering? Wait, what's going on here? You know, but yeah.
But that's cool because that goes back to what I was saying. You know, you adopt something and you adapt it to great.
Yes, I love it. I totally love it.
I do too. I absolutely love it. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know, Lisa? Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, so we only have a few more minutes left, but but I'll have to have you on again for sure, at least a couple times, because we've had so many crazy experiences. Oh. Like you were there for my MMA fight, which I haven't talked about yet on my podcast. And so I totally want to get your version of that whole crazy scenario. But how did we meet? Do you remember?
Okay, can I first say that MMA fight was crazy? Can you do a whole podcast on that? I'll set it up from a viewer's horrific point of view.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Including the gin and tonic I had on my hand.
Exactly.
In the morning.
You guys were throwing down gin and tonics while I was in the
ring. Next to women in fur coats somewhere in Shinjuku. It was weird.
So
and it was
crazy.
Probably
it was so crazy.
Okay, so that's next. But you're saying, how did we meet?
Yes. Do you remember?
Okay. This is a great story. Okay.
Yes.
So I was working at Beacon, which is Beacon Communications, which is really the advertising arm of Leo Burnett in Tokyo. But it was called Beacon because I think we had a little bit of some Saatchi business and another agency, and we were working together with Dentsu. So it was called Beacon. Yeah. And it was wonderful, really creative, amazing agency that was really wacky and wonderful. So anyway, as part of my role as, as a strategic planner, part of it is really understanding consumers and understanding how they think and what they do, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the guys, I think I met because I was like vice chairman of the marketing programs committee of American Chamber of Commerce in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd done some kind of talk on advertising in Japan. Anyway, this guy comes up to me afterwards. He was a sociologist at one of the universities. Yes. And he's like, oh, Linda, really nice to meet you. He said, I'm a sociologist. And I'm like, bing, 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 bing. I love that because sociologists are like, I can download tons of information. I can learn a lot about the culture through them. And he was saying he was even doing his dissertation on hip hop, wasn't
he? Yes. Yes.
Yes.
American white guy from, I forget where he was from, but yes.
Was it Cincinnati? It was just like, it was as wacky Cincinnati. As my background. Yeah, it was nuts. And he was doing that PhD on hip hop. And I thought, you are awesome. And this is really interesting. And I really believe, that music reflects pop, the generation of the time. So I'm like, brilliant. I have to have you come into the office. And so he and I always kept in touch, and he was he's like, Linda, look, I got a bunch of people I want to bring in to your office to, talk about, youth culture, et cetera. I said, great. Awesome. And he said, specifically, there's a girl I want you to meet. You're just going to love her. And I said, tell me more about her. He said, well, she grew up in Japan. I was like, cool. But I'm like, is it really cool or is she a weirdo? Because sometimes, you've got those, it's like, imagine like if a zebra was on a ranch in Texas and it's a little weird. And so I'm thinking to myself, oh, could she be a little bit nutso? But anyway, I'm willing to.
She is.
Let's meet her. But then again, and then he's like, oh yeah. And she's super cool. She's a DJ. I'm like, oh, so she's really cool. And then he said, yeah. And she also was in the movie Lost in Translation. And I'm like, too cool for me. And I was thinking to myself, I said, oh, wonderful.
Diva. But diva.
I'm thinking diva, poser. I'm like, this is no, we're not going to be friends. But anyway, I'm like, okay, this is fine. And so anyway, you all came to the office and we had this lovely conversation, lovely talk. And afterwards, you came up to me and said, oh, my name is Liesl. It's really nice to meet you. You blew me away in the first, I tell you, it was like, I think that was love at first sight, really, Liesl, because your manners, you were as tall as me. And in those days, I wore 3-inch heels. You wore 3-inch heels.
Correct.
I'd like to immediately, based on that, you had fabulous arms. I have fabulous arms. Yeah. I loved you based on that. We both had very muscular arms. And I'm like, oh, I think I like her. But what I especially loved was this kind of incongruency. Suddenly you had this very delicate, like, yeah. So why don't we just have coffee or go out sometime? And I just thought.
Very Japanese almost.
You were so delicate. I never told you that, but you were just so delicate and just magnificent. And I'm like, love it. Let's do it. And you were so sweet. You called me for our first date.
Yeah.
Yeah, my husband's hearing this thing. It's sounding a little bit
it's crazy. Crazy.
And anyway, so you and I went out for dinner or something. And I mean, and the rest is history.
Yes. Totally.
We were instant friends.
Yes.
He was right. You and I were just like, honestly, twins separated at birth. Instant friends, instant friendships. You and I, everything we did, whether it was shopping at, you know, your favorite Roppongi store or getting fake tans in that den, that dead underground den place, or going to, going to the Pink concert.
Yes.
Or going to, you know, thrifting around Tokyo or riding our bike around the Imperial Palace. You and I,
we did
just
so much. We had so much fun.
We had so much fun. And with you were my entry ticket into Japan because we could do anything. Remember that time that we parked our bikes around the Imperial Palace
and
walked away and the guard's like, whoa,
the police came with his stick. He's like, what are you doing? What are you doing?
And then you were talking and you're like, blah, 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 talk, 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 talk. And I heard the word Dentsu. You dropped the Dentsu bomb and said, this girl works at Dentsu. And he's suddenly like, okay, you guys can come here.
Okay, okay. Yes, goodbye. Sayonara, sayonara.
It was so good. So you knew how to get around things. And I loved that. It was just great. And we just, man, it was amazing. And again, I think we could do tons of podcasts just based on some of the crazy adventures we had in Japan as two six foot women.
Exactly.
Remember, we were dripping with sweat at our very first
hot yoga. And we accidentally went to like, not the beginner's yoga. I think we went to like the medium or advanced hot yoga, and the yoga teacher was looking at us like, "Daijoubu?" She kept looking at both of us.
I know.
Just both of us.
We looked like Sasquatch, two Sasquatches.
We really looked like Sasquatch.
But didn't she ask you afterwards if you and I are both hockey players?
Yes, she did.
Yes,
she did. That just goes to show how clumsy we were in that class.
It was, but it was just, I mean, so honestly, funny. We were just too, when you're two big foreign chicks in Tokyo, adventure will find you. Yeah, it is funny. Yeah, hilarious.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much for joining me, Linda, for my podcast. So we definitely have to do more episodes, obviously.
Let's do. Let's
we have
do
so much more to talk about. Yeah. So
especially
so
MMA. Stay tuned.
Yes, the MMA fight. Yes. So I just want to thank you for coming on and thank you for telling us part of your story. As always, I appreciate you so much and who you are, and thank you. And to everyone out there who's listening, I just want to say thank you so much for always supporting me and giving me feedback on social media or even privately, like a lot of you have reached out, and I really appreciate that. And live for lots of love, lots of peace. Let's be good to each other. Thank you so much. This is Liesl signing off on Adventures of a Blonde Geisha. Thank you, Linda.
Linda.
Linda.